Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and everyone's bleary eyes are on tomorrow, Election Day. Will another anvil drop from the sky tonight? Yesterday came the thunderclap from FBI Director James Comey that recently discovered Hillary Clinton-related emails were either duplicates of ones the FBI already had or not pertinent to their investigation into Hillary Clinton's servers. A huge announcement, considering the effect the news of the discovery of the emails seemed to have just a couple weeks ago. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving is here. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Robin.
And first of all, let me hear how you characterize this, because everyone has been saying, you know, Hillary Clinton had opened up a wide lead. And then this first announcement from James Comey, actually in a letter to Congress, that there were emails discovered, is what tripped up her campaign and landed us here with a tightened race.
To some degree, that is true. You cannot undo the effects of an 8-day shift in momentum, and that's really what we're dealing with here. Mm-hmm. The FBI story came at a time when most of the focus had been on the travails of Donald Trump and his sometimes floundering campaign, and suddenly we shifted the focus back to the greatest point of vulnerability that Hillary Clinton has had throughout the campaign, going back to the spring of 2015. So that was extremely unfortunate from the standpoint of the Clinton campaign in terms of timing. They wanted to finish with a positive message. Instead, they had to go back to attacking Donald Trump and trying to change the subject. And now, of course, the director, Comey, has sounded the all clear.
Well, and you know, nothing to see here. But, you know, it's just a couple days before. So the criticism on the Democratic side is that that's just too late to reverse that momentum. Is it? Can they put out ads? Can they quote from it? Or do you think it doesn't matter because people were so hardened anyway that even Donald Trump doesn't believe the James Comey retraction?
You can't get those 8 days back. But let's also put this in a little bit of perspective, a little bit of context. Even before the Comey letter to Congress, there had been a natural movement back towards what we call regression to the mean, back to where the polls had more or less been all along. Hillary Clinton had run out to a double-digit lead in a lot of polls after the third debate and after that Access Hollywood tape really put the hurt on the Trump campaign. So then you get this letter on top of that natural movement that had already brought her back into the middle single digits range, and you get this sense that somehow it's all slipping away. Well, even before Comey had sounded the all clear, we had a movement back towards Hillary Clinton in a lot of the polls. And today, Monday, we've seen six national polls all clustered around 4 points, including the Fox poll, the CBS poll, the NBC poll. It looks like a 4-point race, which is not that far from where we have been on average through the fall.
But NPR also released a new election battleground map today, so help us with this. It features 9 changes from the October 18th version. 8 of those changes, if I understand this, help Donald Trump. We had been talking about Arizona as possibly a state that could go Democratic, the first time since, 1952. So what are you taking from the new map?
Well, they're really not changes that help Donald Trump. They're changes that indicate the limitations on what Hillary Clinton can do on that map. It's no longer a picture of a landslide as it was in late October before the Comey letter and before that movement that I had described a moment ago. It's more like a picture of the 2000 election or the 2012 election. And of course, 2000 was the closest Electoral College tally you can have other than a tie. So this could still be a map for a Clinton victory, of course. It just looks a little more vulnerable. And if she loses one of those blue wall states, especially around the Great Lakes, a Wisconsin, a Michigan, or a Pennsylvania, she will need to win a couple of the battleground toss-ups like Florida or North Carolina to compensate.
Yeah. And just quickly, we only have a half a minute here, but with the news over the weekend of Comey's announcement, markets went up today. People are attributing it to his announcement. What does that mean to you?
It's remarkable that the financial markets took such a grim view back on October 28th of the Republican nominee suddenly looking more likely to win. But that's what happened. With the first Comey letter, the markets dropped like a stone. Today, after Comey's second letter, the markets all shot up more than 300 points on the Dow, even bigger gains on some of the other markets.
NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, now to a non-election story. Rates of sexually transmitted diseases are at an all-time high in the U.S. for the second year in a row, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Since 2014, there's been a 5.9% increase in cases of chlamydia, a 12.8% increase in cases of gonorrhea, and a 19% increase in cases of syphilis. We're joined by Kathleen McDonough, who's a nurse practitioner at Red Door, a Hennepin County public health clinic in Minneapolis. She's on Skype. Kathleen, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, and what are you seeing in terms of STDs at your clinic?
We see every year we see a kind of a constant increase, just as is shown in Minnesota and across the nation, of all these infections. We are a specialty clinic for STDs, and as a result, see, for instance, syphilis, which would be a very unusual infection in other clinics, with quite a bit of regularity.
And what are the reasons, do you think, for the increases?
Well, I'm certain that you know from CDC and the Department of Health that no one really knows. We're all quite interested in it. And if we could figure out the perfect equation to solve it, we would do so. There's any number of possibilities. We rely, in terms of controlling the spread of infection, we rely on communication between people that have been identified with infections and their partners within the applicable time frame prior to their diagnosis. I can tell you with some certainty that many people are left out of that because of client assumptions about who is infectious or who might have carried it and not. Other things that can absolutely limit the diagnosis of infection and therefore the treatment are just the simple access to care issues that we all know about around healthcare in general. So the difficulty in folks accessing care means that fewer people are tested overall on a screening level, and therefore asymptomatic cases go unnoticed and infections continue to spread.
You haven't mentioned apps like Tinder and Grindr. Do you think that those, which make it easier to hook up with people, are increasing the spread of STDs?
That's an interesting question. You know, the possibility that they are increasing the spread of STDs is countered by the fact that the tracing out of infection and treatment of contacts is made easier by online contacts. But anything that enlarges a sexual network and opens it up in new directions is going to increase the frequency of infection.
What about the groups that are most at risk? Are you seeing any changes there?
Our traditional screening model has every female that accesses care when she is 25 or younger gets offered and frequently receives gonorrhea and chlamydia testing. And then there's good reason for that. The numbers of young women or young people under 25 with, for instance, chlamydia is quite high. And as a matter of fact, two-thirds of all the chlamydia cases in recent past have been in that 15 to 25-year-old age range. But we are certainly seeing some increases in, for instance, the over 25s who are not as routinely screened. Infection types, you know, for instance, syphilis rates are higher in probably the 25 to 35-year-old cohort. Gonorrhea has been an issue sort of spread across the board. So there are age groups. There are certainly racial subgroups that appear to have higher rates on a prevalence level of STDs.
Do you find that the level of sex ed and availability of condoms and things like that is adequate right now where you are in Minnesota?
That's an interesting question. A comprehensive sex ed would be just a beautiful thing to truly achieve. I don't think it's the primary. It's certainly not the only solution to rising rates. People can have all the knowledge that they, you know, that's possible through comprehensive sex ed, through access to resources and a milieu in their school or their family that's open and conversational around sex, and still take risk and still get STDs. So I don't think that comprehensive sex ed, while it is a really important thing and ought to always be our goal, I don't think that's the solution to this raising rate.
So is there a solution that you can think of?
Well, I think that the most important thing is for us to keep looking at access to health care. And that both means from the insurance standpoint and the payment standpoint, but it's maybe even more important to simply make this kind of testing be available sort of everywhere. So school-based clinics doing it, very effective way to get cases identified, especially, again, in that 15 to 25-year-old age range. Including STD screening in all sports physicals, considering including HIV and STD screening in any kind of annual physical, whether the person is under 25 or over 25, creating, and this is one thing that STD clinics like us are really looking at, is fast-tracking it, making that visit be very quick and easy, so that we just get a lot more people tested and get their test results to them more quickly.
That's Kathleen McDonough, a nurse practitioner at Red Door at the Hennepin County Public Health Clinic in Minneapolis. Kathleen, thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Yesterday's announcement by FBI Director James Comey that recently discovered Hillary Clinton-related emails are not worth investigating raised new questions about the FBI. Donald Trump's surrogate Rudy Giuliani has said that agents told him the agency was in an uproar because Hillary Clinton wasn't indicted for her emails. Here he is on the Lars Larson Show.
I know that from former agents. I know that even from a few active agents who obviously don't want to identify themselves.
But did Giuliani also know the original Comey announcement about emails was coming? He'd hinted on Fox News about a surprise, but later said he did not know. Then last week, Fox News anchor Brett Baer said his sources told him an indictment of the Clinton Foundation was coming.
These sources said, yes, the investigations will continue. There's a lot of evidence, and barring some obstruction in some way, they believe they'll continue to likely an indictment.
Baer later apologized and said he was wrong. Investigative journalist Wayne Barrett has been following this for the Daily Beast. He's written books on both Giuliani and Trump. So, Wayne, Rudy Giuliani is the former mayor, former federal prosecutor in New York. Of course he'd know agents. What's the problem? You say what?
Well, the problem is not a problem for Rudy. It's a problem for the agents. Rudy actually, when he was at a high level in the Justice Department after Watergate, actually wrote the guidelines that said federal law enforcement agents were not supposed to be in contact with political figures. Mm. Apparently, he doesn't think of himself as a political figure. But it's really the agents that have the problem, if they're polygraphed now as a result of all the controversy.
Well, what does this say about the FBI? There have been analysts who've said that the reason that James Comey even came out in the first place and made public that some new emails had surfaced out of this New York office, that the reason that he did it was there are rogue FBI agents in that office who would have leaked it.
Yeah, well, James Kallstrom, who used to be the head of the FBI office in New York, has gone much further than Rudy. He has said on Fox on more than one occasion that he was talking to agents involved in the campaign. And he has endorsed Trump, and he has known Trump for 40 years. And there are certainly agents within the FBI who have gone way beyond the norm here and who pushed Comey and then have clearly been leaking information to reporters. I regard them not necessarily as pro-Trump agents. They are anti-Clinton agents who think that Clinton is getting a pass on these investigations, and they've gone beyond the norms.
Well, and we don't know who spoke to the Fox News anchor Brett Baer. And as we said, he had to walk back and apologize for his saying that an indictment was coming. But he says he's standing by sources. If those sources turn out to be current or former FBI agents, what does that say?
Well, you know, the House, the ranking House members who are chairs of two committees have already written a letter saying that the inspector general should be investigating this in the aftermath of the election. So we may know what actually went on here.
Well, and Wayne, you've been following this as an investigative reporter for decades. What other questions does this raise for you?
Well, obviously, Comey is a guy of enormously respectable reputation. As I pointed out in the piece, and I, frankly, I don't think it was ever reported before, we have never had a Democrat as an FBI director in the United States in the history of the FBI. Four Democratic presidents, including the current one, have appointed Republicans. So this is an agency that has a Republican culture from the top, so there has to be some measures taken to depoliticize the functioning of the agency. I've known public corruption agents all of my reporting career, and I think they're outstanding people generally. But some of them have clearly gotten the partisan bug and have done some things that are regrettable. I think somebody needs to be made an example of, and this problem will be solved.
Wayne Barrett, investigative journalist, will post some of his writing for the Daily Beast at hearnow.org. Wayne, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, perhaps no issue has defined this election year as much as immigration. And for many Americans, their views on the issue come from somewhere deeply personal, their sense of themselves, their family history. From Here and Now contributor New Hampshire Public Radio, Natasha Haverty brings us two immigration stories separated by 100 years and two continents.
This is Pam.
Oh, okay. I'm Pam Colantuno.
And this is Minata.
Hi, I'm Minata Touré.
Pam and Minata have never met, but they have a few things in common. They both live in Manchester, New Hampshire. They're both moms. And the biggest thing they share, the thing that shapes both their lives and how they see the world, is the classic American immigration story.
Definitely.
So come on in. Can I get you some water?
Inside Pam's big house on Manchester's North End, the faces of her grandparents and her great-grandparents stare out from framed photographs.
This was the family that immigrated from Greece. This was my grandmother right here.
They immigrated 100 years ago.
Why do you think your family decided to come back in 1910?
You know, I don't know the exact reason, but I would assume that it was just one of those things that they said, okay, we're going to make a better life for our children.
On the west side of Manchester, on the second floor of a condominium complex, Minata's immigration story starts pretty much the same way.
I was just looking for a better life.
She grew up in Burkina Faso, West Africa. She was the first one in her family to go to school, the first one to leave home.
All my family, they don't have much education. So for me, having a chance to go to school and knowing that I can have some other possibility, I just decide to try.
And it was a big risk. She came over alone. She barely spoke English.
So it was like if you get lost. That is the feeling that I had the first time that I got here.
That feeling of getting lost, it's something Pam doesn't think her family went through when they arrived 100 years ago. They joined a whole community of Greek immigrants already settled in Manchester. We drive over to her old neighborhood.
This is where my parents grew up. This is the foundation of where my family came.
Almost as soon as we get there, Pam says she doesn't recognize it.
Some of these houses are in shambles. And here's somebody just hanging around during the course of the day, hanging around.
It's still an immigrant neighborhood. The people are just from different countries. At the Beach Street Elementary School, a few blocks from Pam's grandparents' old house, kids speak more than 30 different languages. But for Pam, the difference between now and then goes deeper.
There's no pride. There was an honor about living here. The streets were clean. There was a watching out. There was a village, what they call Paideia. There was a village watching out for one another.
Paideia, that Greek word Pam's talking about, it's the idea of how a culture cares for its own, a kind of support system that Minata hasn't really found since she came here. She misses the community she had back home.
You don't need to call before you knock on his door. You can just take your kid and give him to your neighbor because you have to go here and you have to do this, you have to do that. But here it is not like that. So it is not the same thing. It is not the same. It is not the same.
Nothing here in the U.S. has quite replaced the community Minata had back in Burkina Faso. And the version of community that Pam remembers doesn't seem to exist here either. The longer we spend in her family's old neighborhood, the more upset she gets, until her thoughts turn to how the whole system is failing and that the U.S. shouldn't let any more immigrants in for a while.
Everybody wants to come to America, but we're also enabling, they have a responsibility to our country. And it's just not making a buck and then sending it home, which I know many do.
Making a buck and sending it home, that's also part of the classic immigration story, including for Minata. Within a year of getting to the U.S., she started working full-time as a licensed home nurse aide.
I'm able to have a nice apartment, I will say.
I will say so, too.
Yeah. My own car. And I'm able to help the other member of my family.
And 4 months ago, she had a baby and named him Abdallah.
I'm offering him what I didn't have. And it's feel good being a mom and knowing that you're giving the best that you can.
Back at Pam's house, surrounded by old framed photographs, she looks to the past to find her identity today.
I'll look at my grandparents' picture all the time, and I'll just think of the fond memories. That's why I have them out. The memories are so strong. The traditions are so strong. You're connected. You're so connected.
That sense of connection. For Minata, it's not so much about where she came from as where she is right now and where she's going.
I don't know a lot about America, but I know we're all immigrants. Even those that are saying that we're bad, they're immigrant too.
But she says now, nothing politicians say can hurt her.
You know what I'm really happy about? My son can be a candidate one day too. Because he's an American like Trump. He's an American like Hillary Clinton. He's an American like Barack Obama. He's an American like you, like everybody. I can be outside, but not him, because he was born here and he's American too.
For Here and Now, I'm Natasha Haverty.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. When you cook with fresh, high-quality ingredients, you can tell. Blue Apron creates and delivers pre-proportioned meals with easy step-by-step instructions, all made in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create home-cooked meals. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Wall Street year-end bonuses are expected to be down between 5 and 10% this year. That's according to the consulting firm Johnson Associates. In fact, bonuses have fallen by about a third since 2009. So what's going on? Well, Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. She's here to tell us all about it. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And before we get to this, I think we should probably mention that for the first time in a while, the Dow is up more than 300 points today. A lot of people pointing to the election. What do you make of it?
Yeah, this could be the Comey effect. In the 9 sessions prior, we saw the S&P 500 down about a little over 3%. And then yesterday, when the FBI director said that there was no new evidence to warrant charges against Hillary Clinton, then all of a sudden, wow, a cloud was lifted. Big up day today. Big up day in Asia as well as Europe. We'll see if there's any follow through after the election.
And I guess they're not cheering the fact that their bonuses are going down, because that's what we're here talking about. But what's happening there?
You know, it's been a tough time for Wall Street firms. I mean, no one's crying for them. But, look big picture and you see that this is a firm this is an industry that has been consolidating pretty dramatically since the financial crisis. And obviously it had become bloated before. So that makes sense. We see that trading profits been pretty roughed up, especially in the fixed income area. Global growth has been pretty tepid. deal making is good and bad, but it's sort of sporadic. And when you have interest rates that are really low, yeah, there's a lot of activity, just don't make as much money on all those deals. So put it together and we see that Wall Street profits, especially at the biggest banks, have been under pressure.
And how much money are we talking about? What's the average bonus?
This is when you're really going to hate it, this, okay? average bonus for the securities industry employees, according to the New York State Comptroller's Office last year, $146,200. That's the bonus. Average salary, $388,000. So, you know, just remember that a lot of these bonuses are almost contractually obligated. In other words, that a lot of the big players on Wall Street, they know that they take a lower base salary and they expect a larger bonus. That's been shrinking, though. They really do actually want to sort of make the bonus part a little bit more consistent so the companies can run better.
And are certain employees impacted by this more than others?
Absolutely. I mean, this is what the weird thing is. Let's say that you're a big investment banker, meaning that, you know, you're the person who provides the advice to the two companies that are going to go public or merge. Well, that business has really been under pressure. And we know that equity underwriting, that means guys who are like basically trying to take a stock public, those folks are going to see 20% reductions in their bonuses. Sales and trading, meaning like the guys and gals who are doing stock and bond trading, down 5 to 15%. Merger folks down about 10%. But that's actually interesting because the some of the back office people are seeing good bonuses, like compliance and legal people. They're so needed right now on Wall Street. They're seeing pretty good bonuses.
I imagine there are some people, and we just have a few seconds left, who when they hear this news, even though they don't know any of these people whose bonuses are affected, will say, good, they shouldn't be making so much.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a case to be made for that. I mean, I come from this industry, so I can see the excesses. And just like anything else, though, when you're in the middle of it and you've had your salary going down for 5 consecutive years and you see the companies are doing pretty well, it hurts. So,
yeah,
I don't expect anyone to cry for it. I get it. But it's interesting nonetheless, and maybe it's smarter that we have a smaller industry.
Jill Schlesinger of CBS News.
It's here and now, and for months we've all been inundated with polling data. We've done some of the inundating, sorry about that. But Election Day has long been a day of rest, a day most media agree not to report polling place data, so people voting later in the day won't be discouraged by early returns. Well, that's about to change. There are new polling plans from Politico and the AP, although the data collected won't be about the horse race. A plan from Slate will be. Steve Shepard is campaigns editor at Politico. He's here by Skype. And Steve, remind us how it's traditionally been done. It's not what people may think.
Right. Depending on what network you watch, you think you might be getting some different data. But the reality is that all the networks, ABC, CBS, CNN, Fox and NBC, work together on producing the exit poll. They all have representatives in a room in New York on the afternoon of Election Day looking over the earliest exit poll data in a quarantine. They can't contact anybody. After 5 o'clock, they're able to go out and begin to think about, first of all, what direction they think the vote is headed in, but also what kinds of nuggets that they can dribble out that don't characterize the results. And they're all working off the same data set.
Now we have projects like VoteCaster, C-A-S-T-R, no E there. It's a joint venture from Slate and Vice News. It's run by former Obama and Bush campaign staffers. They're going to be releasing polling data all day long, starting at 8 o'clock in the morning, based on polling ahead of tomorrow that showed who was expected to show up at the polls?
That's part of it. The other part of it is staffers on the ground in key precincts getting the number of votes that are cast at specific times during the day. And using a computer model during the course of Election Day, they're going to be modeling projections for each candidate's vote percentage. A big shift from what the usual information blackout on Election Day. You'll be able to go online and find a computer model that suggests, for argument's sake, Donald Trump is up 2 points in Florida as of 1 p.m. Now, that will change throughout the day as they take in new data. But it's very unusual for any media outlet to report any numbers that characterize the state of the race while voters are actually casting their ballots.
Well, and we should say that Politico, you're with Politico, is partnering with Morning Consult. You're going to do a survey of voters as well, but it's issue-oriented. It's not as much tallying how people are voting. So what's been the reaction to VoteCaster?
The reaction has been pretty split. There are some folks who are really concerned that characterizing the state of the race through this computer model, which at various times in the day may not be completely reflective of the overall outcome, but characterizing the outcome of the race might discourage supporters of one candidate or the other to show up at the polls. There are some folks who are concerned about that, but there are some folks who also say that this information, given how much we know about the early vote thus far and how much anecdotal information we have and how much polling data we have leading up to the campaign, that voters, for a lot of them, their perceptions of the race are formed by the horse race, informed by who they think is going to win. And this might not change their behavior on election day when it comes to actually showing up at the polls.
Steve, quick question. It feels as if technology has changed so much, but also attitude about keeping information till the end of the voting day has changed. It seems like it's going to be pushing us towards something like a national online election. It doesn't feel like there's any other way. If information is going to start coming at voters starting at 8 o'clock in the morning, it feels like it is going to discourage voters, especially on the West Coast, by the end of the day.
We'll have to see. I think there are some folks who are really worried that that will happen. One thing I will say is that here in the United States, we have the First Amendment. In other countries, there are prohibitions against polling before an election and releasing that data to the public. Yeah. There are prohibitions against conducting exit polls or releasing them to the public. Congress has talked about that in the past, and one of the promises that the members of the national election pool, so all those news networks plus the Associated Press, have made to Congress is that they won't release any data that characterizes the outcome of the election until all the polls have closed in a state. And that's a promise they've made in order to ensure that their First Amendment rights aren't infringed.
Yeah. Steve Shepard, Politico's campaigns editor. Steve, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, we have better insight today into the battle to retake Mosul in Iraq from ISIS.
After 3 weeks of this offensive, the Iraqi military is at last about to enter Mosul.
That's Arwa Damon, CNN senior international correspondent, opening her incredible report on what happened when she and photojournalist Brice Lane and the Iraqi troops they were with were trapped for 28 hours this weekend in a muddy alley after entering Mosul and then being surrounded by ISIS. They were eventually rescued by a fresh regiment of Iraqis. Thankfully, Arwa and Brice are okay, but sick about the soldiers and civilians they've left behind who fed and sheltered and protected them. Arwa Damon joins us now from the relative safety of Erbil in Iraq. And Arwa, you show us a little boy in one house after a wall is blown off by an ISIS bomb. He's crying, "I don't want to die." On a rooftop, we see a woman wailing, a loved one shot by a sniper. Then there's a man Iraqi soldiers thought was a suicide bomber. He's running towards them, but he was a taxi driver, and they shot and killed him by mistake.
And that is one of the big challenges that they're facing moving forward. They do not know who's friend or foe. They are on constant alert for these suicide bombers because they have been targeting them over and over and over again. The entire time leading into the neighborhoods, most of the calls on the radio were about watching out for cars. And then this man comes forward in his taxi. They yell at him to stay, to sit. He runs towards them, and they just shot him. Mm. I think the hardest part in all of that is the knowledge that this is probably going to be the dirtiest, toughest battle that this country has seen since the U.S.-led invasion because of the sophistication of ISIS, unlike any enemy that this country has faced before, and because of the reality that Mosul is a massive city that still has more than 1.2 million civilians in it.
Yeah. Well, and what do you take from this? Let's listen to a little bit of sound where the vehicle that you're in, you know, takes a direct hit from ISIS fighters. Let's listen.
Open the door.
You got to get out of here. But then you're, you know, sitting ducks because they have lured this convoy of Iraqi troops that you're embedded with into this area in Mosul with these tight little streets. This goes to the sophistication you were talking about. This was planned.
Planned and very well planned, Robin. There was a regiment that was behind us. What ISIS first did was go after that regiment. They hit them with suicide car bombs. They took out about half of their vehicles. That regiment was then forced to and ended up pulling all of its forces back. So the regiment that we were with was entirely on its own. what ISIS did was allow them to move through the first two neighborhoods with very little resistance until they reached that final neighborhood with its narrow streets, so narrow that you would struggle to turn a car around, never mind turn a convoy around. Mm-hmm. And then ISIS systematically targeted the vehicles at the front and the back of the convoy, eventually disabling almost every single vehicle, forcing the troops out of them into the houses in the area, and basically had them then with us surrounded for 28 hours. Out of the 20 or so vehicles that were part of the convoy that we were in, only three survived. Mm. Towards the end of the report, towards the end of the 28-hour period, we were with 22 wounded soldiers and only six who did not have any injuries, and they were running out of bullets.
Yeah, and they were still running, hobbling on one leg to try to defend you and Brice and the family, the civilians huddled there, and of course save their own lives. You know, we'll link listeners to it. It's must listen to. But Arwa, it's getting somewhat lost. You know, we're day ahead of Election Day. You know, as you're over there, what do you want Americans to know about what's going on there?
The best that we can hope for is that it will give viewers perhaps a greater understanding and a greater level of empathy and compassion for the population here. And I think it's important for Americans to see that and to recognize that, because it can feel as if these things are happening over there. It can feel as if they're difficult to relate to. They're not. Every single parent has at one point in time in their lives felt that unspeakable fear when they have not been able to keep their child safe, or they've been worried that something bad is going to happen to their child. Imagine that fear amplified to a degree that you cannot possibly fathom, lasting not just for a brief second, but for days, weeks on end. Mm. That's what Iraqis are going through as this fight is unfolding.
Arwa Damon, CNN international correspondent. We will link our listeners to the foundation that you've started to help these families at hereandnow.org, along with your incredible work. Arwa, stay safe.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
Tomorrow is Election Day. Finally, it is here. And if you've already made your choices for president, Congress, and any ballot initiatives you might be voting on, you can now turn your attention to another very important issue: what to eat as you wait for the returns. And for that, we bring in Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, Jeremy.
And this election year, I think maybe more than any other, seems like one where everyone can just gather around and just fill themselves up with food and watch the returns.
And they might drink a little bit.
Yeah, maybe drink
but,
a little bit.
But, you know, it's really interesting. I know all these people having election night parties, almost like Academy Award night parties, though, of course, this is so much more important. It's kind of a night you don't want to be alone. You want to be sharing food. You want to be sharing the returns. You want to know what's going to happen to the country. So I always say, let's get some people together and serve something great.
And serve something very unique to this election in
well,
this case.
Well, we had a little bit of fun. I thought about a bologna sandwich, but I went against it. I thought about mock apple pie with Ritz crackers, but I thought, okay, no, let's do real food. So I thought we could start ultimate snack food, ultimate kind of easy to eat on the couch kind of thing, nachos, with a slight nod to Donald Trump, who on Cinco de Mayo famously tweeted,
"The taco bowl.
The taco bowls are the best. Hashtag I love Hispanics." No comment, but instead of a taco salad, I made nachos, and it's a his and hers, and it is a red, white, and blue nacho. So here's what I did. I took blue corn chips, sharp cheddar cheese. Note the sharpness to reflect the election. Then half of it, Hillary Clinton, it turns out, is a lover like you of hot chili peppers.
Yes, I know. She has like a bowl of them in meetings.
She has apparently a chili pepper in a bag with her. She's learned that chili peppers have vitamin C and boost your immune system, and they strengthen stamina. On the other side of the nachos, we have a nod to Donald Trump, where I took overcooked steak. He really likes a steak to the point of no return. So half of the nachos have overcooked ground steak, aged steak, and half of them have chopped jalapeno on them. They also, of course, have sour cream and a nice red salsa. So we have our blue corn chips, our white sour cream, and our red salsa. And, you know, I think if you mix Donald and Hillary up, you get a nice nacho there.
So I have to say, one of the things about nachos is it's not the healthiest thing to have. Is there a way to make nachos in a more healthy way or not?
You know, the real trick is not to eat a lot of them.
Yes,
really.
Just have
like
a few.
Moderation. I say this over and over. Depending on what party you're for, you can skip the jalapenos or skip the steak and make it a pure Dem or Republican.
Okay. And what other nods to the candidates do you have here in front of us?
Well, there were so many choices, but I decided, all joking aside, that we needed comfort food, that this has been the most contentious race and that this is going to be a difficult night for a lot of people, no matter which side you fall on. So I kind of thought of the ultimate comfort food as being a shepherd's pie, but that's classically an English dish. So I made it an all-American shepherd's pie with ground turkey, sharp American cheddar cheese mashed potatoes on top, and peas and carrots. And I made each of them in an individual ramekin. You have one in front of you.
Kathy, I'm trying it right now.
It's delicious. It's exciting, the taste, but it's also like deeply comforting. And I feel like as you get anxious watching the returns, a little shepherd's pie could definitely help. The whole thing can be made a day ahead of time so that on election night, you're sitting around with friends and family and you don't have to be in the kitchen cooking.
And if you get to the point where California's results are starting to come in and it's very late at night and you're ready for dessert, what do you have for us?
All right. Well, Donald Trump had another slogan, Make America Great Again.
He did? I haven't heard that before.
So two women, bakers, Susanna Gephardt and Maya Surdam, came up with the slogan, Make America Cake Again. Mm. So I thought, what cake do you need on election night? And I turned to my good friend, Von Diaz. She is a food writer and radio producer. Von grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, but she is Puerto Rican and spent her summers with her grandmother in Puerto Rico. And she makes a rum cake that is so delicious. Mm. It's boozy. It's moist. It's everything you want in a cake. And it'll help as you get anxious, as the returns are coming in. And I asked her about it, and she says she makes this because it's a classic dessert that brings together the flavors of her homeland, Puerto Rico, with the rum and vanilla, as well as those of her southern roots with the butter and brown sugar. And I would say it is a good combination indeed.
It's just kind of fun to have something else to think about than just what's coming in the returns, to think about taking these nachos out of the oven, getting this shepherd's pie ready, making this cake. It adds a little bit of fun to election
night. I got a few more for you. Apparently, Donald Trump loves food on a stick. You could do chicken on a stick with like a peanut butter sauce. You could serve all kinds of salsas with hot chilies as a nod to Hillary. You know, hopefully we will wake up in the morning with a winner.
And a little bit more of a waistline.
Yes, but the sweetness of it all.
Here and now, resident chef Kathy Gunst with her selections for election night treats. And we will put the recipes at hereandnow.org. Kathy, great to see you as always.
Thanks, Jeremy. You too.
And that shepherd's pie is so good. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.